From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. 1 year after the fall of Mosul in June of 2014, a third of Iraq remained under the control and governance of ISIL, and Iraqi military offensives had yet to significantly change the situation on the ground. Well, Tikrit was liberated in March, Ramadi fell in May. Although the government has an ongoing offensive in Anbar aimed at reversing that setback, the human cost of the conflict remained and remains high. That, according to Jan Kubis, Special Representative of the UN Secretary General and head of the UN Assistance Mission for Iraq, or UNAMI, who presented the bad news to the UN Security Council Wednesday.
Since last summer's onslaught by terrorists of the so-called ISIL, Iraq has been living through one of the most difficult phases in its modern history. The humanitarian situation is of the gravest concern. At least 8.2 million, roughly one in four Iraqis, need urgent assistance, of which half need food assistance.
Kubis said at least 15,000 Iraqi civilians have been killed as a result of armed conflict and ISIL terror attacks in the country since last year. He raised the alarm over the growing number of desperate Iraqis turning to the ISIL terrorist group. The UN envoy for Iraq further cautioned that scores of life-saving programs are scheduled to shut down unless additional funds are received. Meanwhile, the ongoing conflict in neighboring Syria has pushed more than half the population into hunger and poverty, that according to the UN Food and Agriculture Organization and the World Food Program. In a joint report released Thursday, the two agencies said that 5 years of fighting has decimated the country's agricultural sector and caused food prices to rise, with the price of bread alone shooting up by nearly 90% over the past year. As a result, Syrian families are spending more than half their incomes on food. There are as many as 20,000 foreign combatants from 80 countries fighting in Syria, Iraq, and other neighboring conflict areas, including Libya. That, according to the UN Working Group on the Use of Mercenaries. While many of these fighters are motivated by political and/or ideological reasons, many others are paid by foreign powers for their services. These are the focus of the UN Working Group on the Use of Mercenaries, which says it is monitoring their activities. Gabor Rona is a member of the Working Group, which has been meeting this week at UN headquarters in New York. In an interview there with journalist Deanne Penn, he described a set of damned if you do, damned if you don't choices, which he said governments face with human rights implications as they respond to the actions of foreign fighters in those conflict areas.
When individuals go fight in foreign conflicts, they are prone to committing the same kinds of human rights violations that occur in any kind of armed conflict. These would include the targeting of civilians, which is a violation of international law. It would include mistreatment of detainees, torture. But in addition, the fact that an individual is a foreign fighter, in other words, foreign to the locale in which the conflict is taking place, may very well mean that that individual has less of a stake than local people do in peaceful outcomes, and may be more prone to committing human rights violations.
And now for your meeting, what do you hope will be the outcome? I mean, are you wanting to put pressure on home countries that are the sending countries of these foreign fighters or the receiving countries where they're fighting?
Well, both sending countries and receiving countries. And there are quite a number of things that we think states can and should be doing in addition to what they're doing already. Part of the problem, though, is not just the human rights violations committed by foreign fighters. It's also the human rights violations that states commit in their reaction to terrorism generally and foreign fighters in particular. So there are things that states can do. They can tighten their border controls. They can increase their surveillance. They can presumably take passports away from people that are suspected of sympathizing with extremist groups. And all of these things may have a role, but they also in and of themselves create the risk of human rights violations. After all, international human rights law protects people's right, freedom of association, freedom to travel, freedom to engage in the political process. And states have to be very careful to calibrate their reactions to terrorism generally and the foreign fighter phenomenon in particular in ways that address the problem but do not trample on people's human rights. And that's a huge challenge. It's a challenge that I think, though, can be met. And what states can do a better job of is reducing or removing the conditions that are conducive to people joining up with these foreign fighting efforts in the first place.
And how can they do that?
Well, that's the tough question, because we're talking about some really fundamental societal problems. Lack of education, poverty, social disaffection. But any effort in any aspect of counterterrorism that does not look at these fundamental societal problems is bound to fail. And the message that we would like to bring to states is that while border controls, prosecution, preventing people from traveling are all things that have potential roles in any counterterrorism effort, if that's all that states are doing, then they're missing the boat, and they're missing the boat in a way that harms people's human rights rather than promotes them.
There's talk now of snap elections in Greece this September, following the parliamentary vote under the shadow of yet another deadline, which approved the second package of policy changes early Thursday, which the country's creditors had said must be approved before detailed negotiations for an 86 billion euro bailout package could begin, and which some on the left are calling a surrender to capital. The vote was 230 to 63, with 5 abstentions and 2 absences. Press TV's Konstantin Venizelos was outside Greece's parliament late Wednesday night and filed this report.
Thousands of protesters gathered outside the House of Parliament as the second and final package of austerity legislation was being passed. Greek Prime Minister Alexis Tsipras openly considers the 13th or 20th of September a date for snap polls to make a fresh start after concluding the country's bailout agreement in the weeks ahead, despite public anger against it.
People now understand even more that there is no end to austerity inside the European Union and the Eurozone. The people that voted for Syriza and are now disappointed and frustrated will inevitably join the anti-capitalist left that fights for the negation of our debt and national sovereignty away from the euro.
Rendezvous in September, says the front page of Syriza's national daily newspaper, an ominous nod to the party's anti-euro hardliners who opposed the legislation of deeper austerity, an issue that will be dealt with at the September party convention.
The 62% that voted against austerity in the referendum was not a temporary fling with the left. It is a growing movement. Tsipras signed on to a shameful agreement, but in essence, he signed for an ever-expanding leftist opposition, both within his own party and society at large. Tsipras is heading for elections to sanitize the party from the hardliners, but in the end he will lose all the true anti-austerity leftists.
According to an August 20th deadline, Greece's bailout agreement has to be concurred within a month. Otherwise, a failed 3.2 billion euros payment to the European Central Bank could have a negative impact on the New Deal and could revive the Grexit scenario.
The final formulation of austerity cuts into law paves the way for the finalization of Greece's third bailout agreement, but it also sets the scene for upcoming political developments, namely a party-wide Syriza summit in September expected to conclusively realign mainstream party policy, followed by an early national vote. Konstantin Venizelos, Press TV Athens.
The new measures passed with added support from opposition parties who are eager to do whatever it takes to keep Greece from leaving the Eurozone. But the fact that Greece has thus far remained in the Eurozone doesn't mean that it is helpless to fight the effects of these austerity measures, with the example of a socialist Latin American country, Ecuador, demonstrating what can be done by socialist governments confronting the problem in the real world. Like Greece, Ecuador doesn't have a national currency, which means it too has no control over its currency. Dr. Pedro Paez, superintendent of market power control in Ecuador, spoke recently with Telesur about how his country has been fighting austerity despite this lack of currency control, and about restructuring debt with some creative ways of dealing with creditors, including dramatically increasing, rather than cutting, public sector investment and vastly expanding the public economy.
The experience of Ecuador shows that it is possible to have innovative economic policies in order to deploy another type of program, even with the limitations in terms of macroeconomic sovereignty. In the case of Ecuador, we were able to deploy one of the most important stimulus packages without a national currency, with very important restrictions in terms of the fiscal policy. We were able to create another perspective of the intervention of the state in the economy. From an average of 3-5 points of the GDP of public investment during the previous decades, the previous three decades, in the first year of the new government in 2008, we raised to 14%, and in 2013 we reached 16.6%, when the Latin American average is 7%, 7-8%. That means that most of the impossibilities are ideological ones. There are important technical challenges, of course, but it is possible to deploy a progressive economic policies even under duress. The level of blackmailing that the Syriza government had been faced during the last 5 months had shown us the level of the skillful management of the situation on behalf of the negotiators. But I think that it is important to be much more creative in terms, for example, of the new financial architecture at the domestic level for Greece. For example, if they were able to deploy at this moment the electronic possibilities of money, an electronic currency, like Ecuador is trying to implement now, and to reinforce the possibilities of the grassroots organizations in terms of cooperatives and credit unions, like the network of networks that Ecuador has been working up during the last decade. For sure, this offensive of the European Central Bank and the complicity of the Bank of Greece in order to shrink the possibilities for the people, or the Greek people, to withdraw up to 60 euros each week from the ATMs could be put in another perspective. And the alternatives of liquidity policies on behalf of the government could open the margin of maneuver and possibly put the ultimatum of the last week, the last 2 weeks, in another situation. No? The negotiation could be much more successful if the new instruments of the new financial architecture at the level, at the internal level, could be in march, in functioning right now in the case of Greece. There is, of course, limitations, but for example, in the case of Ecuador, there where we didn't have a monetary policy, we invented a liquidity policy. There, where we didn't have enough degrees of freedom in terms of the fiscal policy, we transformed the treasury and the management of the whole intervention of the state, the articulation of the state within the territories and from the central government with the corporate private capitals, but also with the social and popular economy, which render a very interesting synergy in terms of eradication of poverty, in terms of territorial development, in terms of the promotion of productive forces and the transformation of the productive matrix. There where the international commitments around the WTO and other bilateral arrangements in terms of the neoliberal version of free trade restricted our commercial policy space, we invented a new type of import by import substitution policies, a selective and a new type of import substitution policies combined with a market power control in order to avoid the abuses of the monopolies that this type of policies used to create in past decades. The type of import substitution policies like the CEPAL implemented in Latin America during the 50s and the 60s. No? So again, there is a lot of theoretical ground and operative challenges that we have to face, but it is possible. It is very important right now to promote a debate and to build up theory, to build up a new concepts that could help in the emancipation of our minds from the prison of the neoliberal thought. The unique thought had colonized our minds and had restricted our possibilities of hope. But the experience of Latin America, not only of Ecuador, the experiences in Latin America, and I think the very skillful management of the administration during these first months of the Syriza government can show us a lot of venues from which new resources for serving the people are available. This setback provoked by the blackmailing of the Troika against the sovereignty of the Greek people should be put in that perspective as a tactical retreat in order to buy time and in order to prepare the conditions for further conquests. We have to learn from each other. No? What this is very clear is that what has been imposed upon the Greek people against the will of the majority of the population expressed in the last referendum, against the will of the Syriza government, is totally unsustainable, is unviable. And the IMF itself is totally aware of about this. They had several technical papers from their own revision of their policies in Argentina, for example, or in the Southeast Asia, in which they had been very critical about their own behavior, their own performance, and the recipes that they apply there. But even with respect to the same Greece economic situation, they had evaluated, for example, the measurement of the multiplier, no, and they recognized that they had subestimate the magnitude of the sacrifice for the Greek economy for each euro of cutting of the public expenditure. The idea is that right now the estimates are between 1.5 to two euros of economic restriction as a product of one euro cut in the budget, in the fiscal budget. So the effects are totally nocive, totally pernicious against the dynamic of the economy as a whole, but also about the performance of the fiscal situation. Because you are, for each dollar that you cut in terms of expenditure, you are cutting almost the double in terms of the tax base. So the results in terms of fiscal revenue are going to worsen day by day, and that has been the evaluation of the same IMF during the first years. The original cut of the budget had created a reduction of 27% of the GDP, and that is very clear for even orthodox economists. Or, for example, the technical analysis of the sustainability of the debt. Even the IMF had been insisting from the beginning, from the bailout of 2010, they had been insisting on the need to let the banks to fail in order to avoid an unsustainable situation. They insisted from the beginning about the ultimate futility of the colossal injection of 2010 that it worsened the situation of indebtedness of the fiscal situation in Greece instead of improving the condition of the financial sector. The real point there was the political economy, real lenders were the banks, the big banks in Germany and in France, more specifically Deutsche Bank in Germany, Societe Generale in France, that they received every penny that the Troika gave to the between quotes the Greek people. The real effect of those loans for the Greek economy or for the Greek people is almost nil. So what is important is that you have the trigger a dynamics of indebtedness to pay the debt, in which the archaic tributary mechanism had pervaded the whole Greek economy without any construction of productive capabilities, without any openness of new horizons for the situation of the people as entrepreneurs or as a workers, and with a very dim perspective in terms of the reinsertion of the financial Greek system to the international financial situation, and more specifically in a sound relationship with the whole process of European integration. That is not a coincidence. That is not a mishappening. That was programmed as a part of the geopolitical dispute among the hegemons in the economy. We are in the middle of a very sharp crisis of hegemony, and usually in the last crisis of hegemony, we ended up with two world wars. So we have to be very, very aware of this situation. This commercial war, this currency war, must be read in the framework of this overproduction crisis, and the recipes of the IMF are only trying to offset, to neutralize some competitors in order to open space for the expansion of some fractions of monopoly capital.
Hundreds of Apache tribe members from Arizona arrived in front of the U.S. Capitol Wednesday to protest the federal government's plan for a land swap that would allow copper mining in the state. Anya Parampil was at the demonstration and filed this report.
Members of the Apache Stronghold Caravan, members of the Apache Indigenous Tribe, have traveled from southeastern Arizona to the nation's capital, bringing one simple message: preserve their sacred land, Oak Flat.
It's a direct frontal assault on their religious freedom, their First Amendment rights, their sovereign rights as Apache people.
The demonstration began with a prayer, asking for support in their fight to preserve their land. The National Defense Authorization Act, rubber stamped by President Obama last December, contained a little-known bill granting the sacred Oak Flat land to Resolution Copper Mining Company, a measure spearheaded by Arizona Senator John McCain and his Democratic opponent for Senator, Representative Ann Kirkpatrick. And last month, in response, Representative Raul Grijalva introduced the Save Oak Flat Act to the House, aimed at overturning that measure.
Who has the power?
The diverse group of activists rallying this afternoon were overwhelmingly in support of Grijalva's measure.
We have to take blinders off, because, you know, it goes back to the foundation. America has a foundation, but was never, those foundations were never catered to when this came to be. It started with a takeover, colonizing. It started with slavery, upplugging people from foreign countries to bring them here as laborers, and then corporate and so forth. That's how it was founded. So we are where we are today, and it's going to have to take all of us to come back together to rebuild a new beginning for our children.
Reporting from the U.S. Capitol, this is Anya Parampil, RT.
With less than a year and a half left in his time in the White House, U.S. President Barack Obama has begun to talk about solitary confinement, racial disparities in sentencing for nonviolent crimes, and mass incarceration in general. Some say the president is now getting done what he had always intended to do, and that he was just waiting until the time was right. Others, such as Glenn Ford, senior editor of BlackAgendaReport.com, take a more sober look.
President Obama last week took his criminal justice con game into the U.S. prison system, home to 1 out of 8 incarcerated persons in the world. On any given day, about 80,000 inmates are held in solitary confinement, some of them for decades. Obama proclaimed that's not a smart thing to do, and ordered his Justice Department to conduct a study of how to cut down on solitary confinement. If that means Obama's going to pursue a smart criminal justice policy in the same way that he wages smart wars, then not much will change in U.S. prisons. The president waited until the second half of his second term in office and the rise of an incipient mass protest movement before experiencing his epiphany on mass incarceration. So-called prison reform is now a thoroughly bipartisan affair. Republicans have harbored a strain of prison reformism ever since many of Richard Nixon's men found themselves behind bars in the aftermath of Watergate, and even the rabidly reactionary Koch brothers are funding prison reform. The legislatures of at least 15 states have either passed or are debating ways to limit solitary confinement. And Supreme Court Justice Anthony Kennedy, a crucial swing vote on the high court, has all but invited prison reform groups to challenge solitary confinement on constitutional grounds. So, although Obama is the first serving president to actually set foot in a prison, he is moving in politically safe territory. However, don't expect anything other than cynical theatricality and double dealing from this president. When it comes to the criminal justice system, Obama is a consummate trickster. This month, with great fanfare, he commuted the sentences of 46 nonviolent drug offenders. 8 of them had been convicted for crack cocaine. But 2 years ago, Obama's Justice Department successfully argued against retroactive release of prisoners convicted under the infamous 100-to-1 crack cocaine penalties. Because of Obama, 5,000 people, most of them black, were left to languish in prison. Yet, he is praised for letting out just 8 of them under presidential commutation 2 years later. Now that is a champion con man. If Obama had launched his reviews of solitary confinement and other U.S. criminal justice atrocities during his first term in office, then, theoretically, tens of thousands of inmates might have been spared millions of collective days and nights of isolation and psychological torture. But Obama will have less than a year left in office when his new study is completed. 5% of all federal prison inmates are currently in solitary confinement. Federal prisons are 35% to 40% overcrowded. High-security federal prisons, where solitary confinement is most widely practiced, are 55% overcrowded. Obama last week told the NAACP that solitary confinement has no place in any civilized country. But he has overseen such practices for 6.5 years. The NAACP roared its approval anyway, willing participants in Obama's criminal justice con game. For Black Agenda Radio, I'm Glenn Ford.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.